Attention all shipping. The following review of Legend of the Sea Devils was issued by the Diddly Dum podcast on Wednesday the 27th of April. There are warnings of depressions in all areas. Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 164 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
So, you find us, at least two-thirds of our number, rather feeling our age at the moment, faithless listeners, because both Mark and I, entirely coincidentally, have been asked by our doctors to take blood pressure readings while we're at home.
Yes, very odd. A strange coincidence. The only thing we've really got in common, Doc, well, apart from the fact that we've watched some Doctor Who occasionally, is the fact that we're both at the Capital Convention. So,
oh, yes!
I thought you were going to say that you podcast with me.
Well,
I seem to be the common denominator.
Yeah, we both podcast with Hayden as well. I didn't like to say while you were listening.
Hayden just took the words right out of my mouth. So I've had to buy myself one of these little sort of cuffs that you pick up and put on as you need to do it. Mark spent a couple of days in one of them permanently attached to his arm that inflates at random moments.
No, it goes off like every half an hour. But yeah, so sleeping's been a bit problematic, but you know, hey ho, I'm sure it's all fine.
So last time we had Tony Jordan on from the Dwas, looking back on Capital. Is there anything that we didn't cover last time? I think one of the main reactions that Mark and I took away from it was, I think that we felt a bit more confident this time than we, Mark.
Yeah, and people seemed friendlier. I think we said, didn't we, before that it's quite possibly that something to do with like a sort of bit of freedom from the pandemic and being shut indoors for such a long time. But yeah, it seemed a lot more sociable, and I think we chatted to a lot more people. We probably chatted to more people in that one capital than we have done the rest of all the other capitals we've attended, to be fair. Because we pretty much keep to ourselves, don't we? But, you know, thanks to people like Rick Moran and stuff, and Ian and Beef and the Cutaway Comics guys and stuff, we ended up having a lovely old time. Oh, and of course, we, not only that, but it was really nice to saw At TARDIS Monkey. Don't put At TARDIS Monkey, because that's Ellie. That's the somebody else.
Oh, yes.
I got the wrong animal.
TARDIS
it was
parrot.
Really nice to see At TARDIS Parrot, Andrea, there as well for the weekend. And she said to me, this is a holiday for me. And I was like, same here. Despite the strangely high blood pressure, I do normally feel very relaxed and chilled when I come back from an event like that. So that was nice. Oh, there was another chap as well who I spoke to on the Sunday who said he listened to the podcast and liked it. And I forgot to ask your name, probably because I was so surprised to be... So whoever you are, thank you very much for the kind words. And if you hear this, please do drop us a tweet at diddly_dump or an email at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk with your name or Twitter handle so that we can follow you back and get in contact and say hi. I think it's only the second time that we've been recognised, isn't it, at the Capital?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Mark and I, as I think we might have said last time, are fairly self-effacing at Capital events. Partly as I think it's our nature, and partly deliberately because we have a bit of a horror of coming across as being too far up our own backsides. I know when Tony is strong-arming one of his guests and giving us an interview, he'll say, oh, they're the official podcast of the convention, you know, which is lovely. And I imagine reassures them we won't try to shaft them. But I think we tried to go out of our way to not make being the official podcast, in inverted commas, a license to jump queues or swank around or just stroll up to people and demand interviews. And that's why the occasional idea that I have to, oh, let's get T-shirts printed with the Diddly Dumb logo on, never lasts more than 5 minutes before I start thinking, God, what would people think of us?
Yeah.
Look at them showing off. But we were surprised this year at how much more confident we were. Infinitely grateful to people like Rick Moran, who just grab us and drag us over into a conversation. In fact, so much more confident that, and it's only taken us 4 conventions to reach this point, that in fact, next year, all 3 of us will be going to the Capitol. So we might well get, we don't think we'd go as far, still wouldn't go as far as getting 3 Diddly Dumb logo T-shirts. But we might go as far as getting 3 Don't Dump Bodies in the River poster T-shirts so that the only people who will pick up on it and recognise us will be existing aficionados.
Well, I've already got one.
Oh, of
which I have worn to every capital that I've been to.
And which you gave us a bit of information about the other day, which I could really have done without, actually, Mark.
Oh, what's that, sorry?
Oh, things I've done with it's been on the floor next to me.
Oh, sorry.
Well, didn't. There's one for the kids. Well, I'll tell you what, lads. I was so enthralled by the exuberance and the effervescence that you brought back with you, and the other high drugs, too, back to the Hoosium from the capital, that I've gone ahead and booked my hotel room already for next year.
Yay!
Which I think must have taken Tony Jordan by surprise, because his initial response to that news was, which one are you again? Yes, this will be my first convention in 6 years.
Oh, yeah, I'd be really pleased, because it'll be nice just to have the whole gang there.
Yeah, I think so.
And so with Hayden with us, I mean, we will be in full force again. And what we did, I think we were taught last time about how we snuck away from the second panel of the Saturday to go into one of the dealer's rooms and inveigle ourselves into the affections of the Cutaway Comics team who were all there. And we selected who we were going to corner very carefully, didn't we? I had the rather less daunting task of going and introducing myself finally to Gareth Gavanna of Cutaway Comics of Warp fame. You see, the annoying thing about Mark is he has no side to him whatsoever. So people tend to just accept him as being a nice guy when he starts a conversation. So we use that as a main weapon. Whereas Mark and Hayden will confirm that, by contrast, I'm a snide little twat. So where tact is needed, we send Mark in ahead of us. I remember when we got Uncle Terence's autograph, Mark made some crack about him, he should be knighted, and he revelled in it. I made some crack about 30 seconds later, and he's grumpy at me.
Yeah, I did notice that Mr. Comics himself, Des, believed that the podcast was my podcast and asked me how much editing I had to do when you were talking.
I know!
Brilliant.
He said, does it take you long to edit him? Nodding at Doc, I was like, he's the editor.
If Lux could kill, Mark would have left the convention in a basket, honestly. What I think was possibly the most noticeable for me is that whereas in previous capitals, Mark and I would usually be sitting in the bar just making conversation with each other, this time the most memorable thing about the bar was that we could hardly fit enough people around the bar table we were at, just because we had so many people to chat to. And it's nice, that sort of thing.
Mm.
Some of the rumours and stories that we heard, Hayden.
Yeah.
I mean, computer, can you get the Spider-Man music ready just in case?
I mean, yeah, we can't use any of this, obviously.
We were talking about the boys, Deskin and Garrett, and the Cutaway Boys' views on
we
Don't click on images, dog. They'll make your head spin. Your blood pressure will go up.
So, a good time was had by all. Unless you were in the queue at the bar, that is.
Hmm.
Are you saying the next year is a BYOB?
Huh.
It's a what?
BYOB.
Bring your own booze.
Yeah, possibly. No, we can't say that. We'll probably get barred. You can now buy tickets for next year's Capital Convention by going to dwasonline.com/thecapital. Then click on book tickets. And if you book before 31st of July this year, you can take advantage of a special booking discount on tickets. Once you've bought your ticket, you'll be emailed a booking code to use to get the negotiated reduced hotel room rate of £64 a night for the convention by phoning 01293 608 608, or alternatively the hotel contact details are again at dwasonline.com/thecapital, but this time click on the venue. Bit of sad news. Astrid, the Rev's cat.
Oh, yeah.
Has unfortunately died. Mm. So we send our love and sympathy to the Rev and his family. When he told me, I searched within our podcasting records for mentions of Astrid and came up against the lesbian kiss and Astrid the cat. So I had to listen to it, and it was part of our review of Deep Breath. Where, what, did Madame Vastra kiss the maid? And there's a big thing going, oh my god, lesbian kissing Doctor Who.
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
I'm not entirely sure what I think about the Paternoster Trio coming back. I think the Paternoster Trio, at least they're fleshed out a bit more in this story.
The Farris Project pointed something out, Doc, that I hadn't noticed, but I thought, oh, that is interesting, which is that essentially they've kind of taken on the role of the UNIT family now.
Yes.
Which, and then they went through and highlighted who was who, which I don't want to go into at this stage because it made me laugh, and...
Benton. Now, Benton's got to be Strax.
There we go.
Anakin, Benton's Strax. Yep. Jenny is a more likable version of Yates. And there we go. Madame Vastra is the Brigadier.
Exactly. Spot on. Brilliant.
I hope this. You know the line about don't call humans monkeys? She says, no, it's humans are apes. It's men are monkeys. And they giggle together. I hope that's not something if these three are going to stick around, they're going to carry on with. It's a really lazy cliche.
Is that an in-joke?
About lesbians.
Is it? I knew a bloke who told me once he'd had a date with a gibbon, and he had lovely velvet hands, he said. We used to call him the cowboy. He used to sit in the pub in a cowboy hat and a flying jacket, and he used to read tank manuals, like Haynes car manuals, but tank ones. We were just talking about monkeys once, and he said, I once had a date with a gibbon, you know. Lovely velvet hands.
I don't know if it can really be a date, because I don't know whether or not gibbons have signed up. Anyway, what's this? Biggles the later years.
Yeah.
I won't go into the lesbian kiss that's later on, but I do think that's fairly gratuitous. Not because two women kissing.
It's just like kissing you.
By its very nature.
It's like me kissing my cat.
Or going on a date with a gibbon.
Didn't know you had a cat.
Yeah. Astrid.
I'm not saying that she's been kissing.
She's called Astrid. Hang on.
Oh, shut up, that's the pair of you.
That's an anagram of.
Bye bye, Astrid. Lots of love. Have either of you tried to rebuild your Doctor Who Easter egg box from Clayton Hickman's thing on the Twitter?
No, I haven't. But that was quite marvellous. Yeah, the Peter Davison Easter egg from the 80s. Clayton Hickman put out a full PDF of it, didn't he? So that you could print it onto card and rebuild your own one.
The one with Peter Davison's lightning dick in the
TARDIS. Yes, yeah.
Excuse me?
You've noticed, surely.
I nearly spit me Horlicks out when Doc mentioned about Peter Davison's lightning dick.
Anything else been happening? Either in Doctor Who or our lives, other than the obvious, in our lives or...
I've done something.
Have you?
Doctor Who related.
What's this?
I'm trying. I really am, Mark. I very am trying, but I've tried to watch some of Season 17 on Blu-ray.
Oh! Have you made it through Destiny of the Daleks?
I turned it off after the first episode.
Ah!
And I didn't watch City of Death and I didn't watch Sharda because I feel as though I've watched them dozens of times. I mean, different versions of Sharda dozens of times, yeah. But anyway. Tell you the one I did quite enjoy.
Nightmare of Eden.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's got a lot going for it. Have we actually done an episode on that or not?
No, we haven't. No, we haven't.
Should we?
No. No, no, Doc, no, no.
Why not?
Joking.
it'll be one of those... it'll be a happy story, though. It'll be a feel-good tale.
How I learned to stop worrying and embrace Nightmare of Eden.
Yeah, indeed.
I never realised the sort of the undertones, let's say, about the drug smuggling and...
Mm.
I found some of the themes were quite adult, actually.
Yep.
Which is interesting, but it's diametrically opposed to the campy look of some of the costumes and some of the dialogue.
What do you mean? That's one of the most fearsome police forces, intergalactic police forces that I've ever seen.
I'm not going to lie. I thought I just walked into heaven in 1983. When I saw them, I thought I'd walked in and that bass line to Relax had just started. But yeah, I actually quite enjoyed that one.
He does look like a friend of
Dorothy.
Dorothy?
No, the lead singer of Frank
Holly Gershon. Johnson.
He does look a lot like the best friend of Holly Johnson, doesn't he?
Yeah. But yeah, I found that one quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
And then that then pushed me to go back and watch the first couple of stories of season 18 again. And do you know what? If you ever watch Horns of Nymon... I'll say that again because I just dropped my pen. I do apologise.
I thought you were applauding it. I thought you were spontaneously applauding because you'd heard the words Horns of Nymon. Hey! I thought you'd come over to our side, Hayden.
Don't drag Dog down to your level, Mark. Do you know what? If you watch Horns of Nymon and then The Leisure Hive, one after the other, very different yeah, shows, yes. Aren't they?
Yeah,
very different. I can kind of see why Mark would say that Nymon's more enjoyable.
Oh, I really like Leisure Hive, though, as well. But, season 18 is a cracking season.
It is. So, yeah.
But yeah. There's just something that, I do get a sheer joy from.
Well, the thing is, I've spent the last, several years with Mark saying how much he likes it. Mark Cochran, the human palindrome. Hi, Mark. Saying how much he enjoys it. David Kitchen. Saying how much he enjoys them. And then I was listening to a Trap One podcast recently as well. And they used to be talking about season 17. And I was like, is this me? I don't know if this is me. Is it me? I think I'd better just watch these. So yeah, just been putting them on over lunch break, and my opinion hasn't completely changed, but I can find more. I think my angry, bitter, darker, more gnarled side of my psyche is kind of receding a bit.
Well, because that's being expended elsewhere, isn't it, Hayden? In the world of Doctor Who. Well, let's see. We'll find out shortly.
That could be a good segue into it.
In fact, why don't you tell us, Hayden, if you had any...
Legend of the Sea Devils. What a pile of crap.
Where is all your hatred and darkness towards Doctor Who going if it's not going towards Horns of Nymon these days?
You know when you repress feelings, like really dark feelings deep down, and then they manifest themselves in weird ways like decades later?
Yeah, it's probably why I've got this heart rate monitor.
It's probably why. And it seems to have happened at exactly the same time that the Chris Chibnall era is coming to a close.
Not sure I'm going to make it to the centenary at this rate.
No. No, what else have you been doing then, Doc?
Nothing at all.
Oh, okay.
Right. Well, the big thing that has happened in Doctor Who news recently is the broadcast of Legend of the Sea Devils. What's that sound? Oh, it's Mark's.
Oh.
Mark's blood pressure cuff is inflating automatically. Calm down, calm down, calm
Think
down.
Of mandrills, Mark. Think of mandrills. Mandrills playing with balls of wool in a box together.
On Sunday, the BBC rebroadcast The Horns of Nymon as an omnibus. Right, I think it's deflated now, so we can carry on. Legend of the Sea Devils. Directed by Hao Lu Wang, I hope I've got that pronounced properly. Written by Ella Rode, who I must say I've not heard of before, and Chris Chibnall, who he?
She's the youngest Doctor Who writer ever.
Oh, is she?
Well, no, she's not. Andrew Smith was, but of the new series, she's 2 years younger than myself. She's 29.
I noticed you had to slip that in a week when both your co-hosts have reached the age where they need their blood pressure monitored, Hayden.
I mean, it wasn't deliberate, but now I kind of... Now I'm wondering if it was. It was just subliminal. Can I take the floor?
Please do, Hayden.
Go on, take the floor like it's just... like it's your wedding reception.
I always feel guilty when I say, Hayden, why don't you sort of mark what you say? Because I know that you both know that I'm trying to get the good stuff in before I really lay into it. So.
Okay, so I cast my mind back to 2018 when we reviewed The Woman Who Fell to Earth, and I was quite happy with that episode. And I remember saying, in the build-up to Jodie's era, I thought that what Doctor Who should do now is to completely forget about the folklore and just try new things. And you know when you're in a job and things aren't working out and you say to your boss, look, I really want to try something else. Can I just try exploring another aspect of my role, please?
No, I just do as I'm told.
And you try that, and you try that, and you well, we work in very different places. But then you try these new things and you think, no, this really isn't for me. It's like, oh, what was I thinking? I feel as though Doctor Who's been doing that under Chris Chibnall, and then every time I think to myself, no, try something else, try another angle, okay, series 11 was too vanilla, bring back some old monsters. Oh, no, Chris, not like that. All right, maybe strip it back and maybe try and do something different. Okay, a whole long season story arc, oh yeah, these don't tend to work, but let's see how this goes. Oh no, Chris, you've mucked that up as well. It's like every time I think to myself, they need to do this, in my opinion, to get the show excited, like to make me feel excited by the show again. It always ends up just a damp squib. And I remember when the trailer came out for Legend of the Sea Devils. I thought the Sea Devil looked really good. I thought the trailer looked quite exciting. I thought, oh, cool, pirate ships. This will be a swashbuckling adventure. And then I sat down to watch it, and I just thought, and I don't know whether I'm being unfair here, because I don't know whether the series is still being pandemic hit and all the rest of it, but I just found it so underwhelming.
Mm.
And I found the Sea Devil's involvement wasn't really... it could have been anybody. There wasn't anything that really sort of...
Yes.
Made it special.
Window dressing.
But yeah, it was nothing to make the Sea Devils coming back the exciting aspect. I thought Dan was... I don't know why he was cosplaying as Jamie McCrimmon from The Two Doctors. That was interesting to me. I was a little disturbed at the moment when he put a hook on his hand, thinking, oh, well, his girlfriend Diane back in Liverpool is going to be... She's going to be delighted that he's done that.
Yeah, it's the sort of joke that you do with your mates down the pub, but you wouldn't actually do it in front of a disabled person.
No, exactly. But it's these things with Chibnall's Doctor Who being tactless. It's like with Jodie talking to Graham in the last series, not knowing how to do it. And then Jodie wipes out, commits genocide to three different races, and then all of a sudden we've got mocking the disabled. I don't know where the show's going. I'm pleased it's coming to an end. Yeah, it was just an underwhelming episode. I quite liked how they dealt with this whole potential romance between the Doctor and Yaz, because I thought to myself, well, you can fall for people, you know, at some point in your life, but then say to them, but this is the wrong thing to do, because this isn't what I am, what I want, or this is what can't happen. And I feel like the Doctor was doing that. kind of saying, well, yes, you are a great person. I felt like I couldn't quite tell whether she was overhyping Yaz or trying to let her down gently by saying, oh, you're one of the best people I've ever met, but you're not for me. But then here's the other problem. Yaz has never done anything to show that she has justified that sort of ranking in the Doctor's list of companions in her head.
Can I just say, this keeps happening with Yaz, doesn't it? People on screen, other characters on screen, tell the viewers, us, how amazing and brilliant she's been. And yet, a lot of the time, she does sweet FA.
Yeah.
Certainly what happens on screen doesn't back up what people are saying about her on screen. And I think it's a bit harsh on every other companion who there's ever been. Some of whom were absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
To say that Yaz is the greatest of them all. Yaz is, well, not only that, but I mean, the Doctor's met... what about poor Madame de Pompadour? You know, honestly, the Doctor's such a... Basically, if he can't love the one he wants, he loves the one he's with, doesn't he? He doesn't care if she's Miss Wright, as long as... The Doctor doesn't care if she's Miss Wright. She'll just go for Miss Wright now.
Sweet effort. There's a great line in Round the Horn, the old 60s radio thing where Kenneth Horne, secret agent, is investigating, you know, when the World Cup disappeared?
Oh, yes.
1966.
Yeah.
I had to move fast. I called Sir Andrew Sweet, head of the FA, at his headquarters.
Hello, Sweet FA here.
Can I just say that I think among the companions who have deserved more than Yaz, I think Adric's in there. I think Katarina's in there. I think Dodo's in there. I think Chameleon saved lives. You know, I just think, unless Yaz, in I don't know whether Big Finish will do this, but unless she rehoused the Planet of the Orphans or something like that, I can't see what she's done to justify that amount of hype in the Doctor's head. Because we've not seen it. And I'm not jumping on a hype train with everyone else saying, oh, but what's Yaz ever done? But what has she ever done? This isn't what are the Romans ever done for us situation. This literally is one where you'd sit in a room and everyone would go,
No, it's strange, isn't it? Yeah, but what you were saying, Hayden, about, well, you will try this and maybe this will work. You remember people were saying in the build-up to Flux, well, this'll be Chris Chibnall's strong point, because, you know, we saw for Broadchurch that he's far better when he's doing a serialised, you know, series rather than a series of individual standalone episodes. And that didn't work, did it?
No. I just don't think... Don't get me wrong, I've not enjoyed Jodie as the Doctor, and I've not enjoyed her bunch of companions, her friends, the series leads. I think Jodie Whittaker was furthermore undermined when Jo Martin came and played a blinder in the one and a bit episodes that she's had so far. But I do also think that if they'd had a more capable showrunner at the helm, it would have been very interesting to see how this exact cast would have been and would have done.
But you look at a story like this and you think that Jodie Whittaker could be one of the best actors in the country. But you still think, well, how is she going to show that? Because there is nothing. It's like trying to squeeze a zit with soapy fingers. Yeah, there's nothing to latch onto.
I remember Sophie Fingers. She was in my year at school.
I mean, it's clear what this was. This story was meant to be Doctor Who does Pirates of the Caribbean. Just not very well, that's all.
Yeah, but that's really good as well, because they've never done that, have they? Curse of the Black Spot.
No. Do you remember the X Factor series where Alexandra Burke's winner's song was Alleluia?
Yeah.
And people were laughing because this meant that she was having to sing at Simon Cowell. You don't really care for music, do you?
Oh.
I found it equally hard to keep a straight face when the Sea Devil produced the line, do you think such feeble material can hold me? But it's... I did see people saying quite early on... Not quite early on, perhaps in the week or the fortnight running up to this, that I thought we were told it was going to be longer than this. And I don't know if anyone has said, cut 10 minutes out of it or something, but I think after watching Flux, it's no easy thing to claim that any story is the most ruinously edited story you've ever seen. But I think this certainly comes close. I think the Chibnall era of Doctor Who, and this is something that's consistent, has made an art form out of cack-handed editing. And so much so that you can even put the different types of bad editing into categories. There's a sort of editing which seems to be down simply to either bad writing or bad direction.
Yeah.
Like, in the pre-credits sequence, Madame Ching is hacking away at the statue, and finally the thing she wants falls off, so she stops hacking away at it, crouches down, and just looks at this thing on the floor. Ying Wai turns up and says, "Stop!" Well, there's nothing for her to stop doing. And then you repeat, "I said stop!" No, she would do that while she's hacking away at the statue. Why didn't he turn up 5 seconds earlier? Then there's the sort of editing where you have to assume it's the fault of the editor. Like when the Doctor skims that first stone across the water and it deflects off course.
Yeah.
And this is shot from behind the Doctor. And the stone skips across the water and then deflects off course wildly. And there's half a second of looking at her back after this. Then the shot switches to the Doctor's face. There's another half a second of nothing. And then she reacts with surprise. Now, how hard is it to just immediately switch to the Doctor's face reacting with surprise at what's happened?
Can I just say as well, there's that bit in the Flux, isn't there, where you can see Yaz, Dan's behind her, walking up some steps in the TARDIS. The Doctor says something, so the camera goes briefly to her. Then the camera goes back to Yaz, and Dan's just disappeared. He hasn't... Mm. It's been like a second, 1 second. Mm. There's no way he wouldn't still be on those steps. Literally... It's just bad continuity, which you don't expect in...
Just anything that's barely competent, do you?
No.
Sorry, barely competent. This is even slightly competent, you don't expect that. And finally, there's the third category of cack-handed editing, which is where you can possibly sympathise with the editor, because it looks like they've been told from on high to chop 5 or 10 minutes out of the story. Mm. And how can you do that without destroying things? Like where Yaz and Dan suddenly appear out of nowhere with a net... To ensnare the sea devil in it. Where did they come from?
Well, I have to say, during the last, during the recording of our last podcast, I left the conversation just as Mark was saying why the episode was cut down. Do you know, Mark, or is it just something that you've heard? Or?
Oh, no, this is pure. One of the pleasures of the Capital event and talking to people so much was we actually got a lot of what I'd describe as, we got a lot of rumour and gossip, the sort of which we mean,
right.
means revelling. So, yeah, the reason that they claim that perhaps it was something to do with the Chinese broadcaster not liking it, I think somebody said to me.
Oh, yes, I heard that.
So, I mean, that's quite possibly bollocks. But as in, there was some stuff that was sort of like they felt was offensive.
Now, there is this strange thing which... The Chinese state, hang on. Surely this wasn't just something I misread as a joke, was it? The media authorities in China actually ban time travel in films and TV.
Oh.
Because they claim that the notion disrespects history. Now, I'm not sure if that can be true, whether they would have cut something out. But then why wouldn't they just have cut that out for China? And left the rest for us, like they used to do with, you know, one of the only bits of Highlander that we've got left is the bit that the Australian, the ABC, cut out of because they thought it was a bit over the top. And that's the only bit they kept.
I mean, to be honest, I don't see why that would apply to what gets broadcast in Britain anyway, so...
No, it just seems strange, doesn't it?
Very.
But I can't imagine otherwise why it would have been so badly done.
Unless there's some sort of... I think perhaps what the people I'm talking to said that it was because there was stuff that that could be misconstrued as being racist. And I do wonder why.
So, initial thoughts, Mark?
Initial thoughts? Oh, no. Help! Oh, no. Nurse! You know when they showed us the Next Time trailer for Legend of the Sea Devils? And the people go, oh, rah, rage, the Sea Devils are back. This is going to be brilliant. I just thought, oh, no, but it's still going to be Chris Chibnall. I mean, although Ella Rhode is also writing on it. He's quite a young writer, I think. And I just thought, oh, But this era just doesn't seem to do stuff very well, in my opinion. And people going, don't the Sea Devils look amazing? That, like, in that trailer, I thought, no, he looks kind of weird. Looks got a long, skinny neck with a little kind of little tiny round head, and just didn't look quite as meaty as the old Sea Devils from the Sea Devils. And you know, when if you have a dog and it's got long hair and you go out for a walk in the countryside and you throw a stick into the stream and your dog with this long dog looks all big and muscly and it jumps into the stream, then comes out and everything, all its fur is sticking to it, and so it suddenly looks all tiny and skinny and pathetic. That is what I thought these Sea Devils looked like, to be honest. I don't know. I think it's because they've gone, let's give them a realistic neck.
If you made it look better in a string vest.
Yeah, and I still don't. When you got the close-up of that face in the Next Time trailer, I just thought, I still think it looks kind of, I think it looks possibly more ridiculous than the old ones from 1972.
Well, no showrunners without criticism, all of them have got things wrong with them. You know, Doctor Who is an imperfect programme, as is everything else around ever made. It's just the fact that the Sea Devils would have been a more exciting prospect in the hands of someone like Moffat or RTD or, you know, anyone else going back. I think it's just the fact that it just hasn't worked. Chibnall hasn't. Didn't he come out recently and say that if it hadn't have been for the pandemic, he actually would have left after his second series?
You never thought that you could hate COVID any more than you did already.
This is someone, and I've made this point before, this is clearly someone who hasn't enjoyed the job and so hasn't put his all into it, either consciously or subconsciously, and that has been of a detriment to the programme because he clearly is not. He's taken the first, well, I'll say the first available, if the COVID thing's not right, but he strikes me as a man who's seen the showrunner role, not as an opportunity, but as a poison chalice.
I think I said this during the flux, didn't I? So why did he accept it? Wasn't there a suggestion that Steve and Moffat almost had to browbeat him into taking it on?
Hmm.
But he didn't have to. Presumably after Broadchurch, there were any number of people coming to him saying, you know, offering him contracts to write this, this and this, or produce this. Why would he have to end up doing Doctor Who? I mean, I found that quite almost silly, the thing that came out, was it last week or the week before, about how he didn't like it. What was that interview? What did he... Yes, he says he's done with Doctor Who, which there's no way of saying that makes it sound like he's had a great time, is there?
No, exactly.
It's a Radio Times interview. Producing the Doctor Who during the pandemic nearly curtailed his and Jodie Whittaker's three-series and out plan. That we made Doctor Who at all during the past 2 years is a miracle, admits Chibnall. Da, da, da. There was a point around April, May 2020 when it looked like we'd have to call it a day after two series. If we hadn't already planned to leave after series three, there's no way I'd be staying on now after going through that experience. What experience?
Yeah. See, this is it.
Producing during a pandemic, or...?
I don't think he's enjoyed it one bit.
No.
I mean, the pandemic's obviously been a problem. And then the fact that, I mean, this episode, it's passed the Barry Letts and Terrence Dix test, hasn't it? Which is basically, can you get something on screen for the allotted time slot?
Yeah.
Which was their main worry. And so he's passed that test. He's got something to screen. But it's clearly, this episode is clearly, well, I mean, we've said it about a lot of Chris Chibnall, haven't we? Undercooked.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It needs another run-through, it needs another go-through with script editor, it needs another editor to look through. It needs more with the special effects. Because those scenes on the ships in this just look so much like a TV studio. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I understand that this was a particularly rushed episode because, although I think we were probably coming out of the pandemic when it's being produced, weren't we? The restrictions, I think, had been eased, hadn't they?
Mm.
But I know that basically this was supposed to be Jodie Whittaker's finale episode, wasn't it? And then the BBC said, hey, we'd like you to make an episode for the centenary, the BBC centenary, which is what? That's October, isn't it? So he suddenly had another story to bring in. And so the finale got shifted to the centenary, which meant he was suddenly... And so he had to fill in the Easter slot.
Because what was he originally intending to do? When was Jodie going to regenerate?
Easter would have been the finale. Legend of the Sea Devils would have been the finale, which has left him with a gap suddenly to fill.
Mm.
So he has rushed. Oh, one of the things, which you remember when we were talking at the Capitol about production of Praxeus? And I think at the time, I didn't like that episode at all. I felt it was really lacking in any sort of real villain apart from plastic and stuff. And apparently the writer who presented the script to Praxeus, that was a Sea Devil story.
Mm. And
Chris Chibnall vetoed the Sea Devils because he said, no, I want them for one of mine. So they had to take out the Sea Devils from their Sea Devil story, which is probably why Praxeus is a bit, you know...
Yes, I had heard that, because it was the plastic in the seas, wasn't it?
Yes, it was that episode, yeah. So he did want to do a Sea Devils episode.
This is interesting. He says that he asked Stephen Moffat how he managed to juggle working on Doctor and Sherlock. But Stephen Moffat had told him how somehow Doctor Who still took up all of his time. Stephen told me, I miss the work, but I don't miss the workload. That's where I'm heading towards. Now, I don't get the idea that he misses the work. He would miss the work. Maybe it's... All right. RTD is someone who quite naturally, in public, has a sort of jolly, sort of enthusiastic, optimistic way. And it tells you what's going to be happening in Doctor Who. You used to get excited about it.
Yeah.
Stephen Moffat, I thought, he's not quite got that sort of sense of humour, but you almost... Because people are perhaps slightly in awe of his... record as a writer on things, they take more notice of him.
Well, that's because Steve Moffat's peaks are very, as a writer,
fairly high. Yeah.
Yes, they're very peaky, aren't they? But it says here, this is interesting to me, for someone who wrote all 24 episodes of Broadchurch, Chibnall's collegiate approach is striking, and his democratising of the writing team is one of his most significant legacies. Where Moffat anchored his series to veteran writers like Richard Curtis, Frank Cottrell Boyce, Neil Cross and Chibnall himself, this most recent era has been full of new, diverse voices, from Vinay Patel to Ella Rode.
That's rubbish.
From Chris Chibnall to young Christopher Chibnall.
There's a swathe of amazing writers out there, and it felt like I'd be doing the show a disservice if I didn't bring them in, he says. Some of the stories he wanted to tell, Partition of India, the protest of Rosa Parks, demanded an authenticity and a writer's room shaped ideas, with Chibnall having final pass on each script. Now, I thought it was generally understood that he said, I want to have a writer's room.
Mm.
We never saw any evidence of it.
No.
I don't read the reviews in things like DWM of the current series. I don't get the impression that there was a writer's room.
No, there wasn't.
No, that never happened. And what they're claiming there with the... I can't remember what the term was they used for the amount of new writers that Chris Chibnall has brought in. But I wouldn't say it's absolutely stuffed with new writers.
No.
He certainly has brought in some new writers. But most of the episodes seem to be written solely by him.
Yeah, and I have to say, actually, that... I mean, obviously, yes, Russell T. Davies will be the man who brought in the most amount of new writers to Doctor Who by default, because obviously 16 years have gone by between the series. Stephen Moffat did bring in people like Sarah Dollard, like Jamie Matheson, like Peter Harness. You know, there were names there. Okay, yes, it did get a little bit staid, and, you know, the likes of Mark Gatiss and Toby Whitehouse kept seemingly getting a script every season, regardless of how their script had been received the year before, you know. That was a little bit Boys Brigade, wasn't it? Boys Club, sorry, with Moffat, I guess. And yeah, granted, there have been people that Chibnall has found, like, you know, Vijay Patel, Mallory Blackman, Pete McTighe, Joy Wilkinson, who did the Witchfinders. Oh, Maxine Alderton, of course, who did Victory of the Angels. And yeah, I mean, just some really, really good stuff. And of course, The Haunting of Villa Diodati. But,
Village of the Angels.
Sorry, Village of the Angels, sorry. But I have to say, I find that's a bit revisionist, because...
Yeah, exactly, yes.
I can't remember the phrase that the writer used there, but saying that Richard Curtis and Frank Cottrell Boyce are... It sounded to me like they were making them sound like they were mainstays of the Doctor Who writers pool.
Moffat's anchored his series to veteran writers like...
So veteran, so older.
Whereas Chibnall brought in new diverse voices.
Right, okay, so that's two arguments there between age and diversity. That's not a discussion between... You know, Richard Curtis only did one script. You know, I don't see why he's...
Yes, exactly.
...being pulled out. I mean, maybe the writers use that because he's a name.
No one's actually mentioned at any point competence, does it?
I don't know. I mean, one day there's going to be one hell of a Blu-ray collection that comes out about this era. And we'll all get to the bottom of it and we'll discover, oh, things really weren't rosy. Maybe it's the BBC. I mean, the fact that RTD and Bad Wolf and Sony are financing the series going forward. You know, and the landscape has changed. I mean, you got to remember, like, 15 years ago, when Doctor Who was having that sort of platinum period under David Tennant, it was, you know, you had Torchwood was on, you had Sarah Jane was on, you'd have a period in the year where Torchwood would be on after New Year. So you'd have the Christmas special, then after New Year, Torchwood would start. Then when Torchwood ended, I think it was Doctor Who would start. And then when Doctor Who ended, the Sarah Jane Adventures would start on CBBC. So the momentum kept building. And you've seen other things like Marvel take that forward. You know, and of course now they've got the TV series that are running across Disney Plus, and you've got all the things that are coming out. Doctor Who kind of started that, I'd like to say. And then it didn't quite work under Moffat because he was in control of another monster with Sherlock. But I think the landscape's changed to such a point that I don't think the money's there for them to do it now. And I think that's why we'll probably see it under RTD, because it's going to be more of an outside thing now. But I don't think the money's there at the BBC now. And I do think it's probably hindered the production. And that might have been something that got chiseled down. You know, I mean, if you compare the budget, okay, compare it with, obviously, with inflation over the last 15 years, if you gave the same budget to Chibnall's era, to what RTD had. I mean, wasn't David Tennant on like £1 million a year or something when he was the Doctor? And then by the time Capaldi came in, he was on 350k a year.
But doing things cheaper doesn't necessarily mean doing things badly. You might think, oh, that's... If they employed this actor rather than someone who's a lot more expensive. I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that... David Tennant is four times the actor that Peter Capaldi is. So did he bring in these new, fresh writers because he wanted authenticity and diversity, or because...
They were cheap.
Because they're cheaper.
That was one of my suggestions. I said, oh, completely new sweep, bring in new writers. And it hasn't worked. But having said that, I think some of the stuff in there is still okay. You know, the writers I mentioned, I think, did a good job.
But I see stuff now. And I'm not talking about stuff like, you know, the Star Trek spin-offs where... You know, they're clearly spending a fortune on it. But just ordinary, almost bog-standard TV. And at no point are you thinking, my God, what dreadful... In fact, you're almost looking at it and seeing... I find it quite painful because I'm looking at stuff now and thinking, this isn't very good, but... The acting is just miles ahead of what you're getting in Doctor Who. Well, not necessarily from the Doctor or the companions or the guest actors in Doctor Who stories. It's just, there's nothing there of any quality. Whereas you watch any show, you think, well, at least it's someone who, you're not questioning their acting. Here we are. Stories emerged both organically from a shared interest and from serendipity infusing loose threads from different story ideas. Now, that sounds like a sentence that's put together to try to make people give up trying to understand it and just assume that they know what they're talking about.
Sounds like something that the 13th Doctor would say. Yeah. A bit of casual dialogue.
Exactly. Says Chibnall, David Lynch has a great quote. Imagine Chris Chibnall's nerve in associating himself with this idea. David Lynch has a great quote. Plan vigorously and allow for the happy accidents.
But it doesn't seem like he's done either. No. It sounds like he hasn't done any planning and he's had plenty of unhappy accidents.
Plan vigorously, allow for the happy accidents. Everything on this show is that, times 1,000. And this is the funniest bit. He's also taken the elasticity of the format further than most. layering in a Doctor Who origin story, as audacious as it is divisive. A badge of honour for any Who showrunner, it seems. You're not doing your job if fans all agree. I thought one of the greatest achievements of Chris Chibnall is probably uniting the fans.
I have to say, just bringing it back to the story a little bit. Do you remember at the end of The Timeless Children where, oh, I've forgotten the name of the character, but the one who comes in and goes, you get out of here, I'll sacrifice myself. And it happened again in this episode with Gene Hunt. Sorry, G. Hunt.
Yeah, and also in a similar way, although there wasn't much you could do about it, poor old Jericho as well, you know. Though that didn't really necessarily help the Doctor at the end, but it's just another... Yeah.
I don't know.
But yes, it's exactly the same as the Rogan thing. Don't you save everyone, Doctor. I'll give my life to do it. And the Doctor's yeah, all right, see you later.
The Doctor briefly suggests that she'll sacrifice herself. Someone else says, no, I'll do it. Says, oh, yeah. And there's not a sense of any, you know, debate over it.
No, is there?
At least in Ark in Space, Tom Baker had to be knocked out to get him to do it. Now, obviously, no one thinks for a minute that they're going to kill off the Doctor. But at least in those days, they would make an effort like that. I think you could imagine Terence Dix and Barry Letts saying, so you know when the two times when the Doctor jumps from ship to ship, shouting Geronimo?
Mm.
The ships are a long way apart, and one of them is...
Much higher.
Much, much higher than the other one is.
The Flying Dutchman from SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah. And you could say to yourself, well, does it really matter sort of quibbling like trivia like that? But I think you can actually imagine Barry and Terence saying to themselves, no, you can't do that. We must either fix it or not do it. And it seems to be...
Well, also, the stone skimming animation. Now, this is a fairly... You know, basically, when you throw a stone... And you're skimming it, it stays flat on the water. It doesn't suddenly roll onto its narrow edge and trundle. No, but it does though, doesn't it? When they throw the skimming stones, they go on their edge and sort of skim along. They can't make the skimming look remotely realistic. And they do it. They show the Doctor doing it first time, which they should have left it at that. You know, don't show it four or five times if you can't. Animate it. It looks dreadful. It doesn't look anything like a... That's not how skimming a stone works. And it looks crap.
And that's the point, wasn't it? Because haven't we been saying all throughout most of Jodie's era, the one redeeming factor is that it looks great.
Yes, it looks glorious. Oh, didn't that look fantastic? Oh, the lighting. Oh, the sets and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. But the cracks on the statue.
Yeah. Just plain black lines, basically, being drawn over the frames. And the stars moving like that as well. Even if you move, the poles started changing slightly, you wouldn't just see all the stars suddenly dancing around in the sky. It just looks really...
The whole point about the poles moving, geomagnetic reversal, is that, sound like Jodie, is that they flip and the changes, obviously there'd be a fairly disastrous consequences, but essentially the main change is the compasses just start pointing down to the south. Yeah. I wonder if they got the idea that flipping the poles... I wonder if they saw that. I wonder if they... I don't know. Maybe the people who were designing it thought, oh, that means that the planet will literally flip on its axis and Antarctica will now point towards the North Star instead. Well, that's nothing about it.
No, and that's not even what the stars do. The stars sort of just mungle about in the sky, don't they, suddenly? They just start mungling, and that's all they do. And that light is billions of years old. It's coming from those stars.
Yes, that's true.
Even if the Earth was flipping, why would the stars suddenly start dashing all over the place?
You could imagine if all the stars suddenly swung to the left, couldn't you? Because that would mean the planet was turning. But it's just several stars. It reminded me very much of Bad Wolf. Remember when Bad Wolf, when... they realise that the Dalek fleet is hiding on the edge of the solar system. And it's, you know, this, whatever's shielding it, is shielding it from all forms of detection, radar, sonar. They list a whole lot of things. And I think someone mentioned at the time, sonar in space? That's underwater. And this, she's doing that here. She's talking about what the Sea Devils are doing. You're flipping the poles. You're longitude to latitude. Latitude to longitude. which is meaningless.
But I tell you what, Doc, if that's plutonic crystal and your system's below the ocean, a fluo-geomagnetic, then that's probably what's going to happen, isn't it?
Oh, dear, the writing is so terrible in this. I mean, I did think, when I saw in the opening titles, oh, it's been co-written with someone called Ella Rode, who obviously I'd never heard of before. But when, I remember when Mallory Blackman did Rosa with Chris Chibnall, I thought it was amazing. So maybe someone else's contribution will improve it. At that time, I hadn't read the Radio Times review of this story, which contains this interview with Ella Rode, who revealed the unusual way she was inducted into the world of Doctor Who. I basically chatted to them on the phone, and they were like, "Are you in? We need someone immediately." And I was like, "Yeah, cool. So what's the story I'm writing?" And they were like, "We don't have a story. We want you to come and make it up." So there I was, sitting in Chris Chibnall's living room for 3 days and coming up with some ideas.
Oh, dear.
Now, if I'd known that this story was going to be co-written by Chris Chibnall and someone whose idea of reporting direct speech is to say, "And I was like this, and they were like that, and I was like this, and they were like that," I don't think I'd have bothered watching it.
Brilliant!
Yeah.
Words, aren't they brilliant? They kind of like describe things that, you know, people say. And it's just brilliant, isn't it?
So it really shouldn't surprise us to hear clunky lines like, "Your people are conflict averse." Conflict averse? I mean, first of all, we said this in when we were reviewing Origins of the Deep. They're not conflict averse and honourable. The exceptions to the rule among Silurians and the Sea Devils are the nice guys.
Mm.
The rest of them are all bastards who hate us because we didn't die when they all went into their shelters in prehistory. And they're trying to kill us.
Geomagnetic disturbance, maybe a localised core. Might be why the TARDIS was pulled off course.
Yeah.
After her earrings got pulled towards the sea. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, that was odd.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh, hijacked jewellery. It's like, that'd make a nice scene, wouldn't it? How can we explain it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
What's the point of it? And what you were just saying earlier, if that's plutonic crystal and your systems below the ocean are fluo-geomagnetic, who in their right mind gives a word, Jodie, a word like fluo-geomagnetic? It's just lines which have no hope at all of being lifted off the page, least of all by actors who deliver them with all, I don't know, with all the acting skill of someone delivering a gas bill. Maybe inviting writers to sit in his living room with him was all along Chris Chibnall's notion of a writer's room.
Oh, orbital electron stripping.
Even something as simple and non-technobabble as "you really pimped his ride." The script is a bit like the choreography of that final sword fight.
Yeah.
Oh.
In that it's a series of cliches
and
platitudes which someone was thought would sound good, but with nothing to connect them or to justify them, and no attempt to link them convincingly.
No, when the Doctor does that little jump and then does that flip through the air, which is like amazing superhuman agility, and then she can barely slide down that bit of the boat, can't she? She's got dragging her ass.
Oh, that sort of kids slide to a children's playground thing on the edge.
Yes.
You know why that is, Mark, don't you? It's because Jodie actually did the superhuman flip herself, but she did her back in. So they had to get Terry Walsh in to do the slide after that.
And I won't say anything more about the rubbishy lines, but...
Oh, go on.
I think that will have alerted all of our friends' Sea Devil acolytes. How ironic is it that that sounds so much like fortuitous would be a more apposite epithet from Pip and Jane Baker, of all people.
That there's even some shonky dialogue.
Shonky, I love that word.
In the, I mean, it could be because it's heavily edited for reasons of the trailer.
Yeah.
But in the trailer, well, you've got Tegan going, "Ace, I haven't heard from the Doctor in nearly four decades." And Ace says, "Just because it's only 3 decades for me." What?
Yeah, I know.
I don't understand. What? I could have given them some dialogue that actually works.
Oh, my God. I hated that when I saw that. I thought, oh, way to ruin the excitement.
Do you think it was meant to be a bit like, you remember when in the school reunion when Sarah and Rose were arguing about who'd had the best time with the Doctor?
Yeah.
Oh, gas mask zombies. Oh, I met the Emperor. They're meant to be quibbling about, oh, well, it's been I haven't seen the Doctor for 3 decades. Oh, well, I've not seen him for 4 decades.
Yeah, but then why would Ace then go, well, just because it's only 3 decades for me?
I'm not saying it's a good idea, I'm just saying if that's his idea. But I thought there was a really good cue line. You know where she says, just before Yaz and Dan appear with that net, she first meets the sea devil, she looks at him and says, sea devil. And I immediately thought, oh, it's that thing about, you know, it's like calling an ice warrior.
Mm.
One, it's not actually their name, but two, it's actually quite rude. But then he immediately comes back with land parasite, which I thought was really good. Quite a clever line, clever rejoinder. But something could be made of that, which is the whole point. It's supposed to be the whole point about the sea devils and the Sanyors, isn't it? The way neither party thinks that the other has any right to be there. But nothing's made of it.
Yeah, at that point, just after that, she says, I do apologise to fans of Jodie Whittaker, but I really despair of her performance in this episode. I think it's, again, I don't know if it's rushed or not. Or a lot of times she just seems to, use tics and like little, I'll use this expression that I use. I've got this expression, this expression, this expression, this expression. For that line, I'll use A. For that line, I'll use C. For that line, I'll use a bit more C. I'll chuck a bit of B in there. I'll use C. And she does that rather than like properly just reading and acting, it seems to me, because she does a lot of, she does a lot of that half-crouching thing, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Which really irritates me. Maybe it's because I've given up smoking. Might be why the blood pressure's so high, but I get easily irritated. And Jodie's crouching for some reason. That strange half-crouching stance she does. I don't know. When she goes, I'm the doctor, and I just caught a whopper. It's just like, oh, God,
I know.
And also, the way she said, I'm the doctor, was clearly written, because I think the sea devil even goes, slightly, doesn't it? So it's clearly meant to be like that moment when the doctor tells the Daleks, I'm the doctor, and then Daleks go, oh, it's the doctor. You know, and it was clearly supposed to be like that. But that, technically, is the first time that the sea devils ever met the doctor, isn't it?
What's that noise? Oh, hang on, it's Mark's blood pressure cuff inflating again. Calm down. Sit down, Mark. Have a cup of tea.
But it is, though, isn't it? It's,
What are they, a 16th century, is it? Well, she doesn't meet the sea devils until the 20th century.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So John Pertwee's story is in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And then even later on, I think the history just seems a bit confused, like they've forgotten that this is the first time that the sea devils will ever have met the Doctor.
Yes.
But they've not gone back and edited it, so it stayed in.
And what is the point of having people like RTD, Stephen Moffat, Chris Chibnall, who one of the main qualifications for the role is that they are obsessive fans of the show? What if they can't correct things like that?
No. In computer games, you can get a skin, and that is basically where you can change the look of your on-screen character / avatar, whatever it is in the game. It doesn't affect the gameplay or anything at all, just purely how the certain character will appear on screen, and that's called a skin. And I think what it seemed to be with the sea devils was that they'd basically, sea devil was just used as a skin for a generic mysterious monster type.
Yes, yeah, it could have been a Cyberman or a Nogron or a Sontaran. Wouldn't really make much difference, would it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess they're a bit more water-based than that, but yeah. It certainly could have been Nogron as far as Top Trumps were concerned.
But I feel bad about this, because it's as if we're just all railing at the show, but I think when you reach the point where there's really hardly anything good to say about this, then I think it deserves it.
Hmm. I don't think this is just us saying, in our opinion, this isn't to our tastes, etc., etc. We don't like maybe some of my stuff where I get irritated over Jodie's delivery is. I'm not sure. But there's so much in this episode that is bad. And I don't think that's just an opinion.
No.
I think if there's other stuff that you like in it and that you really love, like some people just love the characters. Yeah. And some people just love the idea of Doctor and Yasmin. And other people just love this era and it's just like their thing. And that's absolutely fine. But unfortunately, I think it's just bad bits of this. Really bad.
Well, then there's a whole generation who love watching Hollyoaks, isn't there? So,
Well, yeah.
maybe they're the same people. If you brought up on Hollyoaks, then you're not exactly going to be very demanding about quality of writing and acting, are you?
Well, it's you know, sometimes you just need something on in the background when you've got a hangover on a Sunday. I mean, even the acting, I mean, John Bishop, he's still talking through his teeth, isn't he?
Mm.
He's sort of going like that. Flora the lemur, I thought that went down with the Kama Sutra. What did you say? Well, although he did point out, somehow you've managed to sail this thing here on your own. And that's a good point. But I love the way that's Chibnall's explanation for how... I love that Chibnall's explanation about how Madam Ching sailed the ship around by herself is just, well, somehow she just did it. Reminds me of that bit in one of the recent Star Wars films where they're talking and somebody says, and somehow Palpatine returned. It's like, what? You can't just... I mean, how was she sailing that ship?
I don't know. I mean, even Ellen MacArthur would have struggled, wouldn't she, with a ship that size?
But one of the weaknesses is hardly any story. I think, so who was saying, I can't remember who. I think it might have been the Jodie and Terra guys was on their podcast were saying it's a plot without a story.
Mm.
There's hardly any story. There's hardly any characters.
Mm.
It's just an opportunity to bring back the Sea Devils, and that on its own, it seems that they think that's enough. The guest characters are as thin as tissue paper. Madam Ching, Jean Hunt, and Ying Qi were just ciphers in this. And the Doctor's reaction, she finds out who Madam Ching is. Even I've heard of Madam Ching. Madam Ching, Pirate Queen. Hello, I'm the Doctor, this is Yaz and Dan. And that's it. What do we find out about her? Here's a woman, she's Chinese, and she was a pirate. And that's it. We don't find out anything about who Jean Hunt was. And the characterisation. There's just no attempt at any rational characterisation. Just before the opening titles, Ying Wai, who comes out to stop her chipping at the statue, says, "You have no idea what you're doing." And Madam Ching says, "I was about to say that to you." Draws her sword. "Before I kill you!" Now, I don't know if that's supposed to be impressive. And then when the opening titles then fade out, she stoops by his dead body and sort of gently strokes his cheek in a sort of regretful, there should have been another way. But she's just, I'm not sure if it was she that killed him, but she's just said that she was planning to kill him. Where does this come from? And it's about all she amounts to, Madam Ching. She keeps making idle threats which she never carries out. "I'm going to kill you." I think the Sea Devil ends up killing him. "Help me sail my ship after I've somehow dangled you upside down." Or what? She's more Pirates of Penzance than Pirate Queen. It's a series of boastful lines and impossible actions. You get that with Dan as well. He approaches Ying Qi, the son of Ying Wai, and says, "Listen, I'm sorry about your dad." He didn't know the dad. He doesn't know the son. You didn't see him die. I think wouldn't it be great if we write Dan for a few lines as a comforting father figure? But he can't bring it off. And within a couple of seconds, they forget that, so they can do the comedy, "Let's swim out to the ship." We're not told who Madam Ching is, we're not told who Jean Hunt is, we're not told about what the wreck of the Flor de la Mar is supposed to be, although Dan very unconvincingly knows it was supposed to be sunk off the coast of Sumatra. That's the thing about characterisation, I think. People who question how come Sarah is a cracked shot in Pyramids never seem particularly convinced that it's an argument that holds water. We can fairly easily believe that Sarah can do that, don't we? Because she's Sarah. But Dan claiming to know about this shipwreck simply isn't convincing at all. And it goes on. They decide that they want that kid to want to stay on for a life at sea. So to justify that, in the middle of the ship going down with all hands, they have him laughing gaily, asking, "Is it always like this at sea?" He thought, "That's utter crap." And as I've said more than once, I must be so boring about it now, three things that always got Doctor Who through, despite ropey special effects and perhaps ropey sets, was quality of the writing, the quality of the acting, and the quality of the characterisation. And all three of those are non-existent here. Oh, in fact, it almost makes the Doctor and Yaz a compelling storyline, if only by comparison.
Hello.
Hello?
Oh, hey! I think we've been trying to join in.
For the last five minutes.
We've been trying to interject. And at times you've paused and we've said, yes, and then you've suddenly just steamrolled on.
I'm going to have to get a new set of headphones. I couldn't hear you at all. I do apologise for that.
No, I gathered. At first I thought, because I was trying to say something. Normally, you'd stop and say, yes, sorry, Mark, go on. But you just kept going, and I kept going. And it was like a battle of wits.
I stopped, and I heard nothing, so I just knocked my mic, and I could hear you guys. I do apologise, guys.
That's say right. stuff.
Would you like me to repeat it all again, so you can...
I think you're all right.
Yeah, I got nowhere to go. Oh, I know what I was going to say, actually. It was after you'd said about the killing and about the sword fighting. You mentioned the sword fighting there, right? This was quite a violent episode, wasn't it, for Easter Sunday? Big religious holiday, and then they are. And there's somebody being stabbed through the chest just off screen. You hear that sea devil gurgling, blood-curdling squeal. Then Dan just effortlessly just chops down those half dozen sea devils. Just like, whoosh, 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 and they're dead, and he's just like, he just goes, yeah. He's not like, oh my God, I've just killed six people. Which, you know, I would if up till now I'd just been a... What's his job? Is he a plasterer?
Well, he moonlights as a museum guide, doesn't he?
He said in an interview he was a plasterer, didn't he?
Oh, right.
I mean, for a plasterer, hacking down six people with a sword, you'd think that would, like, be quite a moment.
He'd have to have a character for that, though, wouldn't he?
Oh, well, yeah. Yes, he's got an accent and teeth.
The weird thing about this is the chief sea devil, who apparently, according to Wikipedia, is called Narcissus, seems to be endowed with, and obviously he's not a human, seems to be endowed with superhuman powers. He does that sort of force leap onto his ship right at the beginning.
Mm.
How does he do that? He regularly seems to materialise from a green mist.
Mm. It's a vampire.
I wonder if it's that, because he gets refers to, when they talk about the statue, they refer to him as an ocean demon.
Mm.
And I wonder if the co-writer has been, for obvious reasons, thinking of Pirates of the Caribbean and has taken demon literally.
And devil, you mean?
Assuming that he's one of these sort of supernatural entities with which Pirates of the Caribbean is filled. But he's just another sea devil, isn't he? And he's not even
God. So she's treated it just like a devil type thing. Hmm.
Did she think, oh, he's actually a demon or a demonic figure? He's not even got possession, has he, of the magic jewel that gives him the ability to do almost anything. That's currently around the lad's neck. It just seems, as one of us said, as we were planning to watch this on Sunday evening, it's unfortunate when looking forward to a new Doctor Who has become a bit of a chore.
Yeah.
Mm.
What did we think of, I hate this word, what did we think of Thasmin?
Just unnecessary.
Mm.
I was surprised actually that they said, the Doctor said, thanks but no thanks.
But I would, but I can't.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, I feel really uncomfortable when that's on, and it's not because it's same sex or anything, that's not the problem. I don't know, it's the Doctor and that character interacting, I think, and it's the dialogue, it just feels all a bit...
None of it feels genuine, does it?
No. And it just makes me feel really uncomfortable. And it feels like it's being forced. I mean, I said a lot on the last podcast about how I think Chibnall goes for cheap things.
Yeah.
You know, like say, he'll tell us how brilliant Yasmin is without actually managing to put any of that on screen. And they decided late on, didn't they, that Thasmin was going to be a thing.
Mm.
They said as much at Gallifrey 1, I believe. Was it Matt Strevens at Gallifrey 1?
Yeah, it was. Didn't believe a word of that.
Yeah, and if anyone knows, I imagine it's him. So he'd said, no, we just decided very late in the day. So, you know, it's only been, you know, there may have been natural chemistry, like friend-wise, between the actors, and they decided, let's go with that. And, you know, that was picked up on by certain people, and then it's got turned into this shipping thing. And it's basically giving in to a group of fans, which never works well, does it, for Doctor Who, if you just give in to the fans. But it doesn't feel earned. It does feel like this relationship's just been sort of like tagged on the end of Jodie's era.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem natural for me to see Jodie's doctor being all romantic with another character. It doesn't feel natural. It feels forced.
I sometimes wonder whether it's... You know what you're saying about I don't like... Whenever we say something like, I don't like this sort of thing, we feel we have to immediately apologise for... it's not because I've got a problem with... Well, first of all, the same-sex thing. But you almost have to apologise now when you say, I don't particularly want the doctor falling in love with every companion he or she has got. And you have to almost apologise for that because it's become standardised as Doctor Who fans, particularly, you know, the little boys who never really grow up and they can't handle emotional. It's not that. It's mainly because the whole point of it is that the Doctor switches companions fairly regularly. And if the Doctor falls in love with Rose, then unless he falls in love with Martha, then Martha's just nothing compared to Rose. And unless he falls in love with Donna, then Donna's, you know, less of a character. And if she falls in love with Yaz now, then whoever replaces Yaz, unless she falls in love with him or her as well, is not going to be as good. So the best thing is, unless you're going to have the Doctor falling in love with every single companion and effectively becoming the male or female version of a Gallifreyan bike... It's best not to do it. But if you are going to do it, at least make it... I mean, even the 10th Doctor and Rose was vaguely convincing because at least they were, you know, they were suffused with their own smugness. You can imagine how they were sort of thinking how each other were amazing.
Yeah, it was like kind of, yeah, two narcissists drawing each other in, wasn't it? To their own little narcissistic world.
I do wonder whether Chibnall is saying, well, this could be my salvation for my reputation. If I end up with having to put in the first same-sex relationship in Doctor Who, then no one can criticise me. People already feel they can't criticise it for being as just unconvincing as it is, because they feel then they've got to apologise before they say it. Or I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying this because I'm homophobic or anything. But it's just what I see some people online refer to as gay baiting, in that he's actually looking for, I think assumes that, oh, I'll do this. It's absolutely not convincing at all, but, you know, they'll go for anything. So the Doctor suddenly has feelings she's not hinted at or shown for her entire run, as does Yaz. Ah, there we are. But I did think No Ship Sherlock was a very good line, though. I did think the TARDIS door opening underwater looked very beautiful, but there we are.
Yes, the TARDIS doors opening underwater, possibly the highlight of the episode.
So, next time, trailer.
Well, I think Chibnall's run has been punctuated by really good trailers that don't really amount to much. And I kind of feel that the dialogue, you've already hit the nail on the head. The Tegan and Ace thing I was quite excited for, but then I watched the trailer back a second time almost immediately. And I heard the dialogue that they said, and I thought, oh, well, that's kind of given away what's going to happen then, isn't it, really, is that they're going to be let down by clunky dialogue again.
Yeah, you can't get excited for this episode, can you? All I want to do is I want to hide behind the sofa, and it's for all the wrong reasons. Yeah. But that's what Doctor Who's become for me. Finally, after all these years, after nearly 60 years, Doctor Who's finally made me hide behind the sofa.
I have bad feelings towards the centenary special. I think it's going to be a real letdown.
It's nice to see Dawn French in it, though.
But there's so much going on in it, and you just know that it's going to be a mess.
Yeah.
If it's shorter than an hour and a half, it's going to be...
Yeah.
Well, everyone's in it, aren't they? Dalek, Cyberman, the Master. Didn't someone say they've also seen, what's he called in it? Vinda?
Yeah.
God, I hope that doesn't mean they're trying to bring him back and they find out that his bloody child was the Doctor.
Ashad is back.
The lonely Cyberman or whatever it was. Yeah. The Master, did you say that? The Rasputin Master, which looked very good.
This is like the conveyor belt at the end of the old generation game.
It is, isn't it?
The Master, did you say the Master?
Yes. Who else is coming back for centenary?
Cuddly toy.
Goblin teeth, right? Can't see the cutlery. Oh, hello, Bruce.
Didn't he do well?
So, well, fingers crossed. Let's see. There's certainly one thing I'm looking forward to in the next episode.
Well, can I just say, after Janet Fielding spent all that time on the DVD extras slagging off the hairstyles of the day, she's got some front, hasn't she?
Turning up as Dawn French.
Yeah. I worry that it'll be undercooked and overhyped. Undercooked, over-egged. And ultimately, I think possibly bringing back Tegan and Ace, though it's a nice idea for the centenary, I feel it's being done because it's cheap. Do you know what I mean? It's an easy way to make an event of an episode. I'm not saying that lightly. I'm saying that because I feel that that has been a recurring factor.
It's not to tell a wonderful story about Ace and Tegan. It's to have, like, to have a sea devil back.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So people will say, what I did when Kate said coming next, I thought, oh my God, because I hadn't heard any rumours. Because you heard any rumours of that?
No, no.
No, I hadn't, so I thought, oh well. But maybe we'll, I wonder if they'll manage to peak past 2.2 million next time.
Oh, yeah, I'm interested if they manage to outdo BBC Two, which is the channel that's supposed to be the secondary channel, and Antiques Roadshow on BBC Two beat them, didn't it?
And it was a repeat.
Oh, was it?
Was it?
A repeat?
Yeah.
A repeat of Antique... Oh, wow.
See, regardless of how people spin it, that's poor.
That is poor, isn't it? I know numbers are declining all the time in like this, but that's... yeah, that's hilariously poor.
But someone was saying, happen, I think, on the ratings thread for on Gallifrey Base, I think you people all think that Russell T Davies will come back. And suddenly it will be back as it was in, you know, the ratings were back as it was 2005. I don't think anyone thinks that.
No.
I think a lot of us are just hankering for a bit of basic competence.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Marks out of 10. I'm going to give it a 2.
Right, I might have to revise mine down then.
Might have to revise mine up.
No, sorry. I'm going to give it a 1.
Oh.
I thought it was that dreadful.
I'm going to say 4.
Okay, I'm going to go 2.
2 and 4. God, you two are such enthusiastic fanboys.
I know. That's just because, you know, I don't know. It was just poor. It's just really poor. Poor everything.
When the sole redeeming feature was the line, "No ship Sherlock," in the entire thing. And talking of Doctor Who watching being a chore, our David Tennant era retrospective is coming up soon. So those of you who haven't yet got your votes in, and I imagine most of you who have, I've already forgotten that you put them in. But don't worry, we've got the record of them all. So if you've already sent them in, we'll either ignore your second one, if you said repeated one, or we'll get in touch and say which of the two sets do you want to bother. We'll be pushing this on Twitter in the next few weeks as well. Oh, well, who's this coming to say goodbye to us? Oh, it's Uncle Terence. Uncle Terence. Have you come to tell us something about the bad consequences of going mad and forcing all your crew to jump off ship?
Yes, don't dump bodies into the South China Sea.
Uncle Terence, we have pirate junks in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.